Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. A flag with 37 stars flew over the White House for roughly 10 years after the addition of Nebraska to the Union in March of 1867. It was the flag that flew during the presidencies of Andrew Johnson, Ulysses S. Grant, and Rutherford B. Hayes. And at a special Flag Day celebration yesterday, an original version of that flag was dedicated to the Military Museum and Library of Southwest Florida. Here to talk with us about this unique addition to the museum's collection is curator and historian Jim Zebick. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you, Julie.
Also joining our show today, all the way from the northern state of Maine, is vexillologist Dave Martucci, sharing his flag expertise and the history of this star pattern on the slightly less starry version of our Spangled Banner. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
We are talking about the 37-star American flag that was dedicated yesterday at the Military Museum and Library of Southwest Florida. What questions about flags have you always wanted to raise? Share your thoughts online. We're on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. Or you can give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Museum curator Jim Zebick. So how did this flag find its way to the center of your museum's Flag Day event yesterday?
Okay, we're located in Cape Coral.
Uh-huh.
So there's a family named the Blackburns from Cape Coral. And about 4 years ago, they came to the museum. They had just moved into a smaller residence condo. So they didn't have room for one of their most treasured keepsakes in the family. And that was the 37-star flag, which is about 8 feet high by 4 feet. And it was framed out. And they just didn't have the accommodations for it.
So it was framed behind glass?
It was. It was professionally framed. Cost many thousands of dollars to do that. So
yeah, that's expensive.
They really did a really great job on it. And the flag itself was in great shape to begin with. And the story we got from Robert Blackburn was that it was actually folded in a drawer and kept that way. So when we saw it, it was stretched out and really professionally framed. So we were just happy to really get that flag in that kind of condition. Okay, so 4 years ago, it arrived at our museum, and it was on loan. So the family was in need of funds last year, so they decided to sell the flag.
Mm-hmm. And you were able to get it. Was there a chance of it going anywhere else?
Yes, it was. There was one bidder, and that was the state of Nebraska. And it would have been a treasure for them this year because they're celebrating their 150th anniversary as a state.
Oh.
So they wanted it for their state house or one of their higher-end buildings in the state. So when the offer came through and we found out about it, then we did a counteroffer and offered them more money for it, and they consented to sell it to us. Their reasoning was that they wanted the flag to stay local, and
yeah,
it would be better appreciated maybe in this area.
I can't imagine the cost of shipping. That was something 4 foot by 8 foot.
We have it mounted on the bottom of our one wall, and it is a heavy piece. It is very heavy.
Yeah. So you got it from the Robert Blackburn family, and
mm-hmm.
Do you know how they came to have that flag?
The only story we got from the family was that it was stored through the years, and it was just through that their family.
Just kind of handed down.
They did try and make a connection with the flag maker, the Ann and Company in New Jersey, and we also followed that up and tried to do some of our own provenance on it, and we did find out that their records, unfortunately, were destroyed in a fire, so they had no record of it. It is 1867, which is 150 years ago. So the only thing we have on the flag itself is in the one corner, we do have the name of the Blackburn family on it and also the Ann and Company. The Ann and Company is the oldest flag maker in the United States, the oldest and largest. And
yeah,
they did such historic flags as the moon flag that flies on the moon. And also they did the Iwo Jima flag that flew on Mount Suribachi.
That's an important piece of history there.
It is. Our flag, we're really fortunate to have it. It is a one-of-a-kind item, and it's a treasure in our history, really.
So flag expert Dave Martucci, your area of expertise is called vexillology, which has me vexed. Where did that word come from?
That word was coined by Whitney Smith, who's the premier vexillologist of the 20th into the 21st century. He passed away last year. Whitney coined that word. He took the first part of the word from the Latin vexillum, which was the name that the Romans gave to the first standard that incorporated fabric as a major part of its symbol. And philology is the study of in the Greek language, so he combined the two to make a unique word.
So,
I'd just like to quickly add that the Annan and Company, which he said was the largest and oldest in the United States, which is true, they do claim to have made the flag that flew on the moon and the flag that flew on Mount Suribachi, but in both cases, the government bought flags from many companies, and we actually don't know for sure which company's flag were in both of those locations, although Annan and Company claims both honors.
Yeah, they are. They're a big one, and they've been around for a while. It's unfortunate they had that fire, so you're not able to trace this particular flag. So, Dave Morticia.
Well, actually, there wasn't really a fire. The fire was man-made, and the archives were consigned to it on purpose.
Really?
When they moved out of their headquarters in New York, they deliberately decided to destroy all the records. There was a fire in the office after they moved out, but the paper records had already been moved out by then, and then they were destroyed back in the late 90s.
I wonder why they did that.
It was a matter of trying to, downsize the materials that they had in their office. They had records that went back to the 1830s before they were incorporated as a company. When I was a young man, I lived in that general vicinity, and in the middle 1970s, I was familiar with Annan & Company and the president at the time, Digby Chandler, and I went and visited them many times, and I have had the opportunity to pull through some of their records. I wish today that I had them.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that you'd want to save at least some. I mean, they're pretty interesting.
Yeah, you would think so.
So can you break down for me a little bit the different aspects of the American flag? How have things changed over the years?
Well, the American flag came about during the Revolutionary War as a primarily naval symbol. We don't really know some of the details about its birth, but we do know that it was described as being 13 alternate red and white stripes with a blue field that had 13 stars representing a new constellation. There were no specifications for exactly how to make the flag until 1912. So all throughout the end of the 18th century and the 19th century, just about anybody who made flags could choose their own different spin on what the pattern should look like. So, for example, the flag that we're talking about today has five rows of stars, and there are seven in the first row, then eight, then seven, then eight, then seven. And that's only one of many different patterns that existed at the time. It's similar to the U.S. Navy's pattern, which had rows of 8, 7, 7, 8. And then there were a lot of patterns, particularly as a result of the Civil War, with ovals and circles of stars, big star in the middle, stars of different sizes. The U.S. Bunting Company, which produced its first flags in 1867, which were 37-star flags, that was the first company to produce flags made out of American wool bunting. And that was a company founded by General Benjamin Butler from the Civil War, who was either famous or infamous, depending on how you viewed his governance of New Orleans. And that flag, for example, the first flag that he made, he had presented to the U.S. Congress, and that flag had a diamond shape of 25 stars in the middle with a number of other stars around it, totaling 37. It's a very unique design.
How rare are those?
Yeah, and there's, up until 1912, any flag that had the right number of stars and the right number of stripes was an official flag, whether they were set in circles or ovals or rows or great stars or however you wanted to put them on the flag. I have a link on my website to a chart that was published in the North American Vexillological Association newsletter back in, I think it was 2006. That has over 225 different variants of the United States flag over the years, so you can see a lot of the different patterns that existed.
Did anybody ever change up the stripes? Was it always seven red and six white?
Oh, no. That took some time to develop into a standard pattern, although predominantly from the beginning that was the design. In the early part of the 19th century, there were many flags that had more white stripes than red, and there were even flags that had vertical stripes. Until 1818, there was no specification whether they should be horizontal or vertical, and the flag resolution of 1818 was the first time they specified that the stripes should be horizontal.
Okay, and I'm going to ask a question that might cast me in a silly light, but I wanted to ask, where does Betsy Ross come into all of this? I know as a vexillologist you might hear her name bandied about, but did she really do the first flag?
We don't know. The situation in 1777 in June in Philadelphia, where the flag was born, was kind of different than what we might expect. One of the things going on was that the United States Congress, or the Continental Congress as it was called at the time, was outfitting warships to fight the war. And flags, of course, are an important part of any ship. And when the flag resolution was passed on June 14th, after that, many of the suppliers to the ships had to go out and get flags in the new design made up. And there are several people who claim to have made the first flag. Betsy Ross wasn't the only. In fact, Betsy Ross herself never made the claim. It was her grandson that made the claim. But Rebecca Young made the claim herself. Rebecca Young was another flag maker in Philadelphia. And she is actually very well known to vexillologists because her oldest daughter made the Star Spangled Banner for Fort McHenry during the War of 1812. And they're another long-lasting flag family. So the Young flag family, they've made flags until the Civil War, and Betsy Ross's family made flags until the end of the 19th century. So they were both in the flag business.
So I wanna...
Go ahead.
Oh, so I was going to bring it back into the studio and ask museum curator Jim Zebick about the this flag that we had here, which is from 1867. Take me back to that time. I mean, how much did this flag mean to people at that time? That was kind of Civil War era or shortly thereafter.
Yeah, it was post-Civil War by 2 years. The Civil War flag was really prominent in battle conditions, especially. That was the focal point. That the soldiers would assemble at and in the din of battle they would migrate to. After the Civil War, that would have been 1867, our flag, Nebraska. During the Civil War, there were, I think, 35 states. So I think West Virginia was added during the Civil War, and then came the Nebraska flag. And it was kind of a lull period, I read, until like the centennial year of 1876, when we celebrated 100 years. That's when flag making really took off again. But this was kind of an in-between time, I guess, as far as flags go, from what I understand. So, but the battle flag definitely during the Civil War is when it became really prominent. In fact, the Medal of Honor, our highest military award, was awarded to a lot of the soldiers that captured the enemy banner.
And you have a fragment of an enemy banner.
We do. We have a remnant of a flag that was with the 75th Ohio at Chancellorsville when they were defeated and surprised by the flanking move of Stonewall Jackson. So we do have a remnant of that flag.
And Mr. Martucci, you said you wanted to add something there?
Yeah, just to add to that, it wasn't just the battle flag during the Civil War. The Civil War changed Americans' attitudes about the flag in many fundamental ways. Prior to the war, nobody flew a flag on their own private residence or their business building or anything like that. Prior to the Civil War, flags were relegated to ships and forts, pretty much basically. The military carried it, as was mentioned. But it was during the war that people started to fly flags to show their patriotism in the North. It was the first time that flags regularly were hoisted over schoolhouses. And the national attitude about the flag fundamentally changed during the war in many, many aspects. So It really was a moment in time that really made the public view the flag in a much different way than they previously had.
Do you feel like that might have been the lead up to the early 1900s when they kind of, you know, standardized what the flag was supposed to look like?
Well, it's interesting that throughout the 19th century, there were several people, a number of people, who wanted to have a standard pattern. Of course, they all had different ideas in mind what that pattern should be. Our basic pattern for the flag today, rows of stars, basically derives from naval usage. The Navy always had rows of stars on their flags, where the Army always had either a diamond or a lozenge in the latter part of the half of the 19th century. And there were a lot of different opinions back and forth. In the 1880s and 1890s, a lot of people favored arranging the stars into the shape of a bigger star, often six-pointed, because that's what the stars on the original Great Seal of the United States looked like. So there was a lot of agitation, and President Taft, in 1912, finally decided to make a specification for the flag, and his presidential proclamation only affected the government and the military, but people took that as a directive, and within a few years after the proclamation, virtually all other designs had vanished, and the same pattern was being used. And that was really cemented by the First World War. When the First World War broke out, I mean, everybody wanted to have the flag look exactly the same.
And before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you, Museum Curator Jim Zubik, what was it like to unveil this flag in front of visitors, members, veterans yesterday during Flag Day? What did it feel? Were people in awe?
We were. Because we own it now, it was really a special day for us. We had Representative Trey Radel there, too, for the unveiling of it. So we're especially proud of the fact that we're getting young people into the museum and that that will be a focal point of our tours of the museum as we travel through history. We're probably one of the few museums that touches on all eras of American history, from the Revolution all the way up to the Desert Wars currently going, and also other types of 19th, 20th century history. So this is really a focal point for us. It's really the centerpiece of our flag area. We have it draped between a GAR flag that's also authentic to late 1860s. That was the veterans flag that was very popular after the Civil War. And also on each end of our display area, we have American flags that were found at the were donated to us from the White House in Washington. So they flew in Washington, D.C.
Great. Well, we have links to your website so that people, if they want to go out and visit, they can do that by checking us out at WGCUnews.org. But we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank our guest, Museum Curator Jim Zubik. Thanks for joining us today and sharing this flag and its history with our listeners.
You're welcome. I hope to see you at the museum.
You probably will soon. Also, I want to thank flag expert Dave Martucci. Thanks for joining us from the phone all the way from the state of Maine. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.